This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
So starting with Shema Yisrael, which is the beginning of any kind of emunah, so you could develop that idea a little bit as to why I start, and one of the answers to that question is to why brachos doesn't start with any brachos. And therefore Shema comes before that. So you could develop all of that. This is all good. It's not fair. This is for people who are busy learning smicha, not for people who've got smicha already.
And therefore, if the Torah starts with something, that beginning is what you're aiming for. That's the goal.
So what would you do then in explaining with all of what you've said? So why doesn't the Chumash start with Shema Yisrael?
So that's actually what you discuss, is why the Chumash starts. And the question should have been,
he asked, why don't we start with Shema Yisrael?
Well, it could be that
Rashi
is already teaching
him
the principle of
Shema
Yisrael. Teaching that Shema Yisrael, and then
after. Okay, all that is good. All that is good. All that is good. All that is good. All that you're saying is good, and some of the questions that you started raising is absolutely the right approach in terms of noticing the things that are out of order, so that you can start looking for the way to create it, innovate it, to deal with it. No, it's not a question of more basic. Yes, my point with what you're saying is they're nice groshes for Friday night, but they're not Gemara Shir. It's not Gemara Shir material. Shema is the most important thing, and this is our relationship with the Gemara. These are all good things, and one can talk about it around the Gemara, but this is generally a Friday night groshes, or Shabbos morning groshes material. It's not Gemara Shir material. But the fact that you've thought on this and you've started developing will help. And I'll show you how I would teach it, and see if you can gain some benefit from that, and see how we go. The first thing is not only that we start with Kriya Shema rather than with brachas or with anything else, is the first word, once again, the same as we had with Kiddushin, is Me'emosai. We're starting with not a why question. One would expect Shas to start with a why question. Why do we say Kriya Shema? What's interesting is we start with a when question, which assumes already that you know what Kriya Shema is. So that's already an introduction to Gemara, that there's certain assumptions. When you start learning Gemara, there's certain assumptions. But it also deals with a definition of halacha, because halacha is not a why issue. And as much as the process of questioning is crucial, as we discussed yesterday, and there are all sorts of different questions that one asks, what, how, when, where, why, the why question is the philosophy, and we'll deal with that in Gemara, but that's not our first question. We have to understand. The first questions we have to ask is what? Well, we're not Kriya Shema. And then questions like how and when are things that the halacha deals with. By starting with when, the Gemara is introducing us to an idea that the Western world has only understood very recently, and that is that time is a dimension of an object. That just as you talk, when you're talking about any object, you define the object in terms of its dimensions. One of the things you define it by is its time dimension, particularly when it comes to mitzvahs. That a mitzvah performed out of time is a mitzvah with the wrong dimension. That's like if you produce an object, if we want to make a pocket tape recorder, and design a tape recorder like this, but we design it with proportions like this to get good sound, it's the wrong object. It does all the right things, but it's the proportions are wrong. It's not the right thing. So if we perform a mitzvah and we're medactic in every part of the mitzvah, it's just out of time, it's not the mitzvah. And we'll see that in the Mishnah, because that's something that people also struggle with a little bit. Oh, what's the difference? He said, Kriya Shema 2 minutes late. What's the big deal? It's a big deal if time defines. not just that there's a time to say, it's time defined, and we're going to see with the Shofar of Kubecho that we're talking about part of the definition of the mitzvah. If you're missing that, it's like missing any other part of the mitzvah. In longest terms, we talk about it as being one of the tznoi ha-mitzvah. And one can discuss with the fact that tznoi of the mitzvah, that the mitzvah is complete at another time, the mitzvah is complete without time. It's just an additional tznoi. When do you do it? You do it in such and such a... It seems in the mitzvah's kriyashma, time is not a tznoi in the mitzvah. That if it's not in the time, it is no mitzvah. It's part of the gedder of the mitzvah. The mitzvah is lacking. The mitzvah is not complete if it's not time. And we'll see that in the Rashi. That's the one thing. The next thing that's interesting is mei ein osai. What does the Gemara answer? What is the Mishnah's answer to the question of mei ein osai? Sorry? From when it goes on. That's not the end of the answer. It gives a range. Ad. Who asked ad? We asked mei ein osai. Then the Mishnah should say the ad ein osai. Mishnah, this is not part of mei ein osai. If that's what we want to ask, if we're looking at the range, then what should the question be? Amosai, without the mem. Amosai, when do you do it? What is the time period in which you can read the Krishna? But that's not the Mishnah's Kasha. The Mishnah's Kasha is mei Amosai, when does it start? So for some reason, the first Sugya in Shas is focusing on the starting time of Mitzvah's Krishna. That's what it is. The subject of this Mishnah, I would suggest in teaching it, is not Krishna. The subject of this Mishnah is what? Time. The idea of time, the concept of time, the beginning of the time unit. Mei ein osai. At what point does the mitzvah of Kriya Shema start? Why is that so important? Why is it important for us to pinpoint the time of starting Kriya Shema? Apart from the dinim of Kriya Shema, philosophically, why is it important to pinpoint the time of the starting of Kriya Shema? On time, okay, but why is the time of the starting of Kriya Shema so important? And the hint to it is in the answer. It doesn't say Mishas Hashkiya, doesn't say Mitzvah Sekhovim. It says, but look at the answer, very good. It says Mishor Shakranim Nichnosim Rechol Bitrumoso. What does Rashi say? How does Rashi explain that? That's the technical answer. Okay, that's the mathematical answer. So we're learning an additional piece of information that we wouldn't have known otherwise, and that's an efficient way of teaching that information. That's the technical answer, which the Gemara comes on to, and that's important. But that isn't philosophically satisfying. That doesn't make you go out and say, wow, mind life-changing. That's a good thing. They gave us two pieces of information instead of one. Thank you. So we've got to find the life-changing messages as well. So the Rashi explains, what does Kranim Bishor Shekranim Nichnosim Lecho Bitrumoso mean? Kranim Shinitmu. Kranim become Tomei. The Tovlu, and he goes and he tables. The He'eriv Shimshon, and Shkia comes, nightfall comes, and thereby he gia itom lechol b'truma. The time has arrived to start eating truma. Now just think for a moment of all other secular and other religious approaches to dusk, to nightfall. What is it? Well, it's negative and scary, and what else? It's the end. You're winding down. End of my day. What do you notice in Rashi? What's the mood in the Rashi? Anticipation. I've gone to the mikveh. Now he comes out of the mikveh, 10 o'clock in the morning. Now what does he do? He waits. For when? Shkia. For the arrival of Shkia. Why? What is so special about the arrival of Shkia? The beginning of a new day. Now this takes you into a whole understanding, because then the Gemara goes on and says, when the Gemara itself starts, Tano Hecha Koi de Katoni Me'emosai. Two questions. Where are we standing that we say Me'emosai? So that's the one thing. The second question is, Maishna the Tani Ba'arabis. Why does it start dealing with Ma'ariv B'Reisha Litni B'Shach Respiration? Start at the beginning of the day. Start with Krishna. Krishna is twice a day. Start with Shachris. That's the time to start. So the Gemara two answers. Tanu Akrot Kri Dichtiv B'Shofar Hol Kumecho. ואחי קטן לזמן כפי יש מדי שכיבו אין אז משהו שכן נכנות נכו בתשובה עשו ביבי זה מיולת מבריאות שלו אילום זה צוותי, סורי? ובאת למה צנעת כמי? Oh, so what do we see over here? Let's start with the second one first, with the general one first. What do we see here? The Vayivake, that in itself teaches us the whole thing. So this gives you an idea when you're teaching Pasha's brochures and you bring this in. But what is Vayivake? Is our day starts at night. Now you might say that's a simple thing, and what's life-changing about that? I'll tell you what's life-changing about that. What's life-changing is the Tzvila Tashkivayinu. How does it say Tashkivayinu Hashem Akinu Shalom? Shalom. V'ha'amidenu Makenu L'chaim. So you go to sleep in preparation for getting up, not as a reward for a hard day. Sleep is not a recovery from hardship. Sleep is hachona. Now what that does, and you can try it out yourselves, if you go to sleep and you go to sleep with that in mind, I'm going to sleep in order to prepare myself for tomorrow. And before you go to sleep, some of the really great businessmen, by the way, one of their very important stories is before they go to sleep, one of the most important times, when they're misadder the next day. They get all their email organized, they get their timetable, their schedule for the next day, everything is organized, they know exactly what's going to be the next day, every minute of the day, before they go to sleep. They don't do it when they get up in the morning. If you go to sleep, so that's the one thing, you go to sleep with your day worked out. And to go to sleep as the first act of hachana for the next day, and compare the way you wake up. And you will find that you wake up with a lot more vitality. You will find that you wake up easily. You find that you wake up on time without an alarm clock. You find that you've got kriyah, that you slept well. The impact on the way you wake up by the way you go to sleep is unbelievable. And you can try it and you can test it out with your friends. It works amazingly to change the paradigm of nightfall, of what night is. Night is the beginning of a new day. Night is a hachonah. And people generally, nine times the time, they run down, and it becomes a very wasteful time also. It's a negative time. For us, it's a time of build-up. We're getting ready for the new day. We're getting involved. There's another area that is really important. One of the reasons that most changes that we introduce in our lives fail, and very often they fail on the first day, is because we decide to start tomorrow. I'll go on diet tomorrow, I'll start learning a new Seder tomorrow, I'm going to get up and try to feel the Tzidur tomorrow. All sorts of Kabbalahs we take upon ourselves and we say, I'm going to start it tomorrow. If you understand that the nighttime is the beginning of a new day, you want to start a new Seder, you want to start a new Kabbalah, the day starts at Shkia time, that's when you start. The postponement of the beginning to the next day kills the beginning. And if one understands the principle of Vayivake, then there's an urgency to implementing a new Kabbalah, and the immediacy of that start gives it a completely different energy. Yeah, and the La Asher means not like tomorrow, it means absolutely now. So when you're working on with this whole thing, so the Me'emosai now comes, Me'emosai. Kriyashma, you said correctly that Kriyashma is the most important thing and it defines our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam and it's central. Therefore, when is the most likely time that we would have to say Kriyashma? The moment the day starts. That should be before anything. So if we can define the time that you say Kriyashma, we can define the moment that the new day starts. So Me'emosai is not just about defining a time for Mitzvah's Kriyashma. Me'emosai is from what moment do we begin the process of a new day, and what inaugurates a new day? Kriyashma inaugurates a new day. So if that's the case, why Bekumecha? Why do we say Kriyashma in the morning as well? Because there's a problem when you go to sleep at night, and that is that although you've started beforehand, when you take a break, you know that Chaim Shmuel is the famous verse with the Yaakov Avinu. And when it says in the prayer that he came to Beit El and he slept with the Mayol and Shom and Chazal say there he slept, but for the 20 years in Shem Be'ezer he hadn't slept. And Chayashul Eretz used to say he hadn't even slept like that on the ground with a stone for a cushion. He hadn't slept. And why not? Why didn't he take a little nap? What would be such a terrible thing? And he's doing some Rabbi Akiva as well with his wife. He comes after 12 years and he overhears her saying that I wouldn't mind if he goes back to another 12 years. And the Chayim used to say, what would be the terrible thing? He'll get in the Peshul Ma'arikim to his wife. And he'll say, I heard what you said and that's beautiful and I'm going right back. I just want to come and say Shalom Aleichem and to thank you for being supportive and not again. What would be such a terrible thing? And the Chayim used to say 12 and 12 is not 24. There's a difference between 24 and 12 plus 12 or the hefsek in between. And the problem with sleeping is it's a hefsek. How do we know? What's the raya that it's a hefsek? How do we know that sleeping is a hefsek? If I'm sleeping in Shem Shemayim, why should sleeping be a hefsek? The raya is I have to say because I said it again in the morning. If I take a little nap in the afternoon, according to most possible, I don't have to say Birkas HaTorah. But if I sleep, I have to take the Birkas HaTorah, so it's been a hefsek. We need to know that the Kabbalah I made last night, although it was at the beginning of the day and that's the right time to make it, has to be reaffirmed after hefsek. Because a hefsek is a very dangerous time. So there are two dangerous times when you're starting something new. The first dangerous time is that when you begin it, don't postpone the beginning. Start the beginning at the beginning. The second dangerous time is if you've had a hefsek. When you come back, it can all be gone. That's why vacation can be a dangerous time. One can achieve lots of things. You can go away on a vacation, you come back, and it's sometimes difficult to get back into that same routine. There needs to be a reaffirmation of what you were mekabel yesterday since it's been a hefsek. So here one gets onto a whole understanding of the beginnings of things, of hefsek, even though you have to sleep. It's not a question you shouldn't sleep, you have to sleep, and it's good to sleep, and it's hakonah for the next day. But there's still a danger involved, which takes you into another discussion, and that is that the Torah accepts that you have to do risky things too. That's life. The management of the risk. So the solution is not, I won't go to sleep then, because I've reached such a high madrega, I don't want to lose it. And that sometimes happens. You're learning late at night, and you're getting beautifully, and you're excited, and there's a yetzer hara, not to go to sleep. But you carry on learning later and later, and that can wreck your davening the next morning, it can wreck all sorts of things. It's an absolute yetzer hara, not to go to sleep. One has to go. You have to go to sleep. I might lose out. When I come back, I won't be on the same level. And that's fine. So you've got to work out what to do about that. You've got to manage that risk. And that's in life. We have to be doing that all of the time. And then the Gemara goes on, and the Gemara says, but what about the next Mishnah? If that's the case, also Mishnah, Hachi Sefer, Dishtani B'Shachar Mevarech Shtayim Lefaneh V'Achash L'Achareh, when the Gemara is talking about the Birkas Shema, it puts Shachris before Ma'ariv. So if you've just said that Shachris is the beginning and Shachris must come first, why in the second Mishnah do we put Shachris before Ma'ariv? Answer the Gemara. That's the method of reasoning, says the Gemara. If you learn A and then you learn B, when you go back to B and then you go back to A, which is contrary to the way we do things in Western civilization. How do we do things? If you're writing a thesis, you make point A, and you make point B, and you make point C. Then you go back to A, and you analyze B, and you analyze C. And then when you summarize, you go back to A, and you use B, and then C. That's the way we operate. The Gemara doesn't work that way. And here you've got an opportunity to discuss the system of reasoning of the Gemara. But the Gemara doesn't work linearly. And why doesn't the Gemara work linearly? So you go A, B, B, A. That's how the Gemara works all the time. Why does the Gemara work that way? Why does the Gemara not go linearly? Why does the Gemara not lay it out? A, B. Let's go back and analyze. A, B. A, B, B, A. Why does the Gemara operate that way? Because the Gemara operates the way the mind works. Western civilization operates in some different kind of an order, kind of an objective order, to make the thing look good in terms of its layout. We like a sense of order. But the mind doesn't work in an orderly way. The mind works by connection. And one of the things you've got to be very careful is not to break connections. If your mind is moving from A to B, don't break that. While you're on B, finish B. So you're going to have to break one of them, but don't break both. To get back to A, you're going to have to break it. But if you have an opportunity of staying with B, stay with it until it's finished. Don't break. That's how the mind works at its best. You have an opportunity to talk about the structure of Gemara, because one of the most difficult things people find in the learning of Gemara is to say this. How do things operate? Where do things go? The point you made about the Rambam, if you want to see how a good seder, a good structure is, look, you learn in the Rambam, that's a good structure, but that's not the Gemara structure. And that was a big chiddush in the Rambam to change the structure, and he was criticized for it. And the Rambam understood that the Gemara is structured for learning, the Gemara is not structured for accessing. A very, very straightforward halacha l'maisa. So he picks up his Rambam. I said, that's odd, why are you looking at the Rambam? Why not look at the Shulchan Aruch? So he said, I can't find things in the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know where to look in the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam is so logical, it's so ordered. And that's true. The Rambam has structured his order in a way that facilitates accessing the information. If you want to find something, you've got no idea where it is, you don't have a masab, you'll find it in the Rambam in 5 or 10 minutes. You'll know where to go. You'll be able to navigate yourself through. Go and find something in Shas. If you're not an incredible Baki and you don't have these anthologies and things, go and find the Chazal. Where are you going to look? There's no way you could possibly know where it is. There's no logic as to why something is in this Masechta and not in another Masechta. So what is the structure? People struggle with that. The structure is the thinking. So you're able to introduce them the whole idea. Gemara is a process of thinking. Gemara is not a body of knowledge. It's a process of thinking, and Gemara guides you along that process of thinking, leads you along that process of thinking. It's not designed to access information, it's designed to develop and to enrich a process of reasoning. So those are some of the things. There's one more point which I'll show you, which we can bring out as well, but there's a bit of longness in that. But just the process of going through the text of the Gemara in a very superficial way, you're able to introduce a person into things that can make a difference to his life that day. And at the end of it, you summarize. You say, these are the things we've learned from it. These are the lamaisatik things we've learned from it. That makes it very difficult for the person to say, I don't want to come back to the shiur tomorrow. Because the value of what he's learned already is something that would make it very hard for him not to want to come back to the next shiur. And it's really important that in completing, somebody was asking in the Beis Medrash earlier today about the fact, comments on something that I said last night, that we've kind of got to be worried about people going off and doing all sorts of other things and being distracted from learning. Yeah, we won't have to worry about that, but we also have to know that we as teachers have an obligation to make learning more exciting than any distraction. And if people are distracted, it's our failure, not theirs. One of the hardest things I had to learn, and probably anybody who teaches or speaks, if somebody falls asleep in your class, don't get angry at them. You failed. You failed to hold their attention. Now, they might be very tired and there might be all sorts of reasons, but still the fact is, if it was an exciting movie, they wouldn't have fallen asleep. That wouldn't have happened. So if somebody's fallen asleep, you failed. And that becomes very important to understand, that the obligation is on us to make the Torah you don't have to make it, the Torah is like that, to expose the Torah's excitement in a way that makes it not possible for anything else to compete with it. And that's a very tough challenge, and that means that the hakhona that you have to put into your teaching, apart from the energy and the enthusiasm with which you teach, the mere hakhona, just the degree to which you're focused on preparing, as I said yesterday, after you've prepared the Gemara, after you know the Gemara, it's another few hours to get this kind of stuff out of it and to work out how to present it and how to bring it across. That's how I phrase it with the Hanukkah. We've got to be doing that. Each on the level of the people we're teaching. If you're teaching London, you get the excitement through the London. If you're teaching newcomers, you get the excitement through some of these things. And somewhere in the middle, you'll combine both of them. But it's terribly important that we don't teach it in a way that almost drives people to the competition. And that's something. The Rebbe has given us the most powerful vehicle. Why should we not use it? And why should we not display it with its full power and teach it in a way that is dull and boring? Are there any comments on that before I do one more thing with it? No, it's a good question. First MS is when you've got the Boris Bear was once on Ben Benner's money. Said, they're right. I cannot teach you anything more about how to learn, what to learn. I can only teach you how not to learn. And the role of a Rebbe is not so much to teach how to learn, it's to teach how not to learn. And the role of a rov and a mechanech is not only to teach how to live, it's to teach how not to live. The first time when I was in Marosh Hashiva Shir, and Veli Mishkovsky, the room was full, and he didn't want to let me into the shir, and he used the fact that the room was full as the excuse. So I said, I'll find a place. If that's the only reason, I'll find a place. So the only place I could find was next to him. So I used to bring in a chair, and I used to sit next to him. So I'm watching the shir and how it works, and after a few weeks I plucked up the courage to ask a question. He was a very tough visitor. You had to be quite courageous to ask a question, or very foolish, and I was foolish to ask a question. And as the question came out of my mouth, I realized what an idiot I'd made of myself. I realized it was such a stupid question. How could anybody ask such a stupid question? But the question was already halfway out. I couldn't stop. And I knew what was coming. I knew he was going to tear me to pieces. And I finished the question, and I just waited for it. I braced myself, turned around, put his arm around me, and he showed me something, and he explained it nicely. I went to him after the shir and I said, I'm not a total idiot despite of what I are. I said, I see the shir divided into three groups. There are the good ones, there are the average ones, and there are the bad ones. I see you ignore the average ones. I see you treat the good ones too terribly for words, that you're horrible to them. And I see you're very nice to the weak ones. So I feel insulted with the way you dealt with a really bad question today. And that was the end of our civil relationship. From then onwards, he used to destroy me and attack me. And that was very important, and that's Teres Emes. When I went to see Rav Meir Soloveitchik the other day, he said his first words to me is, it's the first time I see you since you've emigrated to America. I said, you're right, this is the first time I've been back to Israel since I've been. So he said, how are the Americans? So I said, they're a different world. So he smiled. He says, you've got to tell them they're all right all the time. Fine with an American. But that's not Teres Emes. Teres Emes is when you're not all right, you've got to tell a person you're not all right. And that's a hard part, because the and I think it's one of the areas that Rabbonim are failing today most of all, is not telling it as it is. When there's a need to. There's a time when there's not a need to. There's a time when you need to be subtle, and there's a time. But sometimes one has to teach something, and ways of doing it, whether you're teaching it with a text, or you're talking to somebody, guiding them, giving them some mussar, where you really need to, in order to challenge and stretch them, is to, sometimes you need to hurt them. I say in America that the only educational relationship left in American society is between the gym instructor and his Talmud. Because in every other educational relationship, if the teacher hurts the student sues. Why did you hurt my child? Why did you abuse my child? Or whatever it is. And then in college, it's the same thing. The gym instructor is the only person you pay and you say to him, hurt me. I don't mind you hurt, because I know I'll only grow if you hurt me. So what would you do? If the gym instructor was like other educators in the United States are, after you, if you're capable of doing 20 press-ups, by the time you've done 12, you say, no, I'm tired. He would say, okay, so stop. We'll do something else. Don't have to do press-ups. Finish the business, and you won't make any progress, and that would be fine. But we don't. We empower the gym instructor to push us and push us and push us and push us. And that's what a rov is. A rov is not just there to tell you you're alright all the time. That's an entertainer's job. A rov and a mechanic. He's a different dog. So the question is that the way of doing it has to change. You cannot do it with the same kind of skiffness that you used to do it before. But you can't afford not to do it. If you don't do it, you're depriving a person of the opportunity of growth. And one of the ways of
that inventing new techniques to make sure it's all working.
So the one way is to make a deal right up front. So do you want me to be your entertainer or your gym instructor? And then you've got to decide. If the person answers you, I want you to be my entertainer, then you've got to decide whether you want the job. But at least you know what you're in for then. But usually that won't be. The person will say, no, I want to grow with you. So you've got to say to him, but in that case, there are going to be times when it's painful and uncomfortable. Because I'm going to confront you. And I expect you to do the same with me. Doesn't matter. I'm not afraid of it either. But that's what it means. And each time you then confront the person and he gets offended, you have to bring him back to that discussion. So, you know, this is what we discussed. I know it's uncomfortable, whatever. And the other thing is to sugarcoat. The difference between this door and previous doors is poshut and how much sugar coating the pill has to have. Not to give the pill the shaker, That's a sugar coat the pool. You're a great guy, but you know, I'm sure you could do better. I'm sure it was just a slip up. I'm sure, you know, that kind of stuff to keep the person's dignity intact. But the need to confront people with something that isn't right is very, very important. Very, very important. And there can be times when it's very uncomfortable. There can be times when it's very difficult.
So we said, I don't know if that was an issue. I think we said yesterday. We said one of the biggest challenges is to remain honest. To remain honest and keep away from Shekhar when you're paid by people who don't always want to hear the honest. So it is in the learning. Terribly, terribly, it's one of the hardest, most difficult things. When somebody does something in the shul, we had a case with a person who should have known better, is almost a Sherman Lipsis, married out, married a shitzen. And the person was a very important donor for the shul, very important, somebody very, very important. So now what do you do? And then went through a conservative conversion. Now he wants to study before the Omer school, and he wants to be called up to the first term. Answer is no. No. What can you say to the other young people in the shul who you're saying don't intermarry if you're still giving COVID to the people who do? How can you give that message? So then he went and he got a conversion from an Orthodox Beis Din in New York. A frum Beis Din, a good Beis Din. He got a conversion for this woman. It was a Chinese woman. And he has a trait even to this day. And he came to me with a conversion certificate. So I told him what a Rav once told me. There's certain hechsherim that Rav told me that are meyid that the product is kosher, and there are certain hechsherim where the product is meyid that the hechsher is treif. You know, you go and put a hechsher on chazer, it doesn't make the chazer kosher, it makes the hechsher treif. And it's the same with geirus. And I had to say to him, it's not okay. So he went to another from Kehillah who accepted him with open arms. Why not? He's got a lot of money. And with a conversion, it's not their problem. They've got a family kosher building. Who are they to question it? That's not okay. That's not right. Sorry? It was a kosher building. How did they do it? Could it be that they didn't know that they did? I don't know. Or was there money involved? I don't know. When I say kosher building, I mean it's a building with a reputation. I didn't discuss it directly with them. I discussed it with the Rav of the Kehillah who accepted them. No, I'm a father. That I wouldn't mind. That I wouldn't mind. The fact, at the end of the day, there was a conversion. It was a conversion of the halacha. She's makabel the Torah, the mitzvahs. You know, the conversions in the United States is a little different from the way it used to be in South Africa. But in South Africa, the conversion process was so painful that it wasn't an attractive option. It was easier to marry a Jewish girl. You know what I mean? So nobody looked at that and said, oh, it's so easy, I'll do it too. In the United States, it's different because it is much too easy. Because you'll always find somebody to do it, and yes, that is a major problem. But that's an example of where the Torah Chaim is. Let's get up and teach that we mustn't marry out, and how important it is. That's the Torah Chaim. Your question is Torah Chaim is, what happens when your most important balabos marries out? Now what do you do? And comes with one of these fakey conversions. Now what do you do? Now it becomes... Your Torah Chaim becomes compromised if it isn't Torah Chaim. And there are those tough times that you have, and you have very, very often, where you've got to be, where there's got to be an honest cut, and some people will respect it, and others will not, and those you work with the ones who do. And one of the hard things also, you sort of learn to say, it's something you learn to appreciate more and more as time goes on, that nobody should open a mosque if they don't know how to close one. Don't open a shul, don't open a Beis HaMedrash, don't open a branch of Eishet Torah if you don't know how to close one. That means your ego shouldn't be tied to it. Because that's for the emes. If it's vitally important for your income or for your ego that the place has 1,000 people in it, or 500 people in it, or 50 people in it, then losing one person becomes something you're not prepared to do, and very often you're willing to compromise as well. So that's not good. Oh, for different reasons. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Really close. You can do this with any sugya. You can't always do it with a part of a sugya. Sometimes you've got to get a person through the whole sugya before you can do it, and that can be a bit challenging. So in the early stages of Gemara, it's important that you don't choose sugyas that are that take too long to be able to do this with. If they get the gishmak, and then it doesn't matter. Then you can go through a longer sugya. But sometimes you've got to get through the material before you can begin to analyze it and take it to pieces and use it in a way that is life changing. Those are the best. Why? I got it to your feet like your feet are medrash. I got it to you. You've got to interpret that agadah. And you occasionally get an agadah which is just defies any kind of understanding. And you've got to say that. I don't understand this agadah. I don't know what it means. I don't know what the message is. Something deep. But usually, agadah allows you a lot of opportunity for exploring ideas. So agadah is important to do. It uses an opportunity to. To know which agadah you've got to teach literally, which agadah is an image for something that isn't necessarily literal, to be able to distinguish between those. Sometimes the perushim on that agadah helps a little bit, like the marshal or the maral, sometimes that helps a little bit. Yeah. I think it is important. I think what's important though is that for example, this will be, and it depends also what age, because there's an age at which the child gets so much of a thrill from mastering the technicality that it doesn't need anything more. And that's why the structure of the Mishnah Pirkei Avos with the Ben Chamish Lamikra and the Esra Lamishnah is designed exactly according to the child's intellectual development. That a child has been between 5 and 10 loves stories, loves narratives. That's really what excites him. So that's the time to take advantage of that and to get it through as much of Kumish and Tanakh as you can. A child of 10 likes information and has a mind like a sponge. He'll take in information and he'll take in information. So he gets very excited by mastering information and can sometimes get frustrated by getting involved in the philosophy because he just wants more and more and more and more. Once the child of 15, you certainly should be learning like this. That's when the Gemara should start. But even at a young age, to throw in little bits of it, just to sweeten it up a little bit, child an idea of it. No. Mishnah is not affected by that at all. Now, Pekelvis is around. Pekelvis is. But Mishnah is, when I say it's not affected, it doesn't. Mishnah is really for 10-year-olds. Now, that doesn't mean that adults should be learning it, but they should be learning it as a means of tekiyas, as a means of putting things into particular perspective, as a means of linking their Gemara into the bigger picture. But this is a limud. Mishnah doesn't satisfy intellectually. Unless one learns it really be here, and you're going to move, then you might as well learn the Gemara. So Mishnah is a difficult one, and it's a difficult thing to teach in a way that is satisfying. Unless you do very short shiur, after that, you do 10 minutes, and a Mishnah or two for 10 minutes, that's fine. But to hold a person's interest in Mishnah is very difficult, to make it alive, to make it vibrant, to make it life-changing. Difficult, except that they might be the office. Which is powerful. Firstly, I was fortunate in that my father started training us already when we were little kids. Find Chiddush and to explore, so we got a lot of that. But I think you'll be surprised that once you start it, how quickly you start finding not only that you're good at it, but you find amazing Chiddush in it. I wouldn't learn like that in Yeshiva during the Seder. I got involved in a lot of this as deeply as I could. But then in the night time on Shabbos, I would sometimes take a sugya that I've learned and figure out what I could get out of it and what it was really all about and what the principles were. Also, what's interesting, and that's not an altogether accurate answer, because Rav Shimon's derech, one understands Rav Shimon properly, and a lot of people don't. And Marish Shiva was a Talmud of Rav Shimon, and my father was a Talmud of Tells, which was the same derech. Rav Shimon's derech, which a lot of this, the Brisk is criticized. Which although the Rav Shimon was the Talmud of Rav Chaim, the Brisker Rav's approach is so completely different. Rav Shimon's is to use the philosophic and psychological yesod of a sugya to explain some of the technical difficulties. So I think I got a lot of it in there, that even when we were dealing with technically difficult the things we would, there was an essence of looking at a yesod that had a human component and using that to open up the sugya, whereas the briskas are absolutely mathematical in their analysis of the sugya. There would be no admission of any philosophy or psychology in explaining the sugya, even in explaining a medrash. They wouldn't. It's a different outlook, a different approach. Absolutely. Ramban says it, Chaim works on it a lot in the Nefesh HaChaim, others as well, because if it just means what halachas emerge from it, then what do you do with kodshim and things like that? So clearly there are yesodas that the Ramban is saying that you can get from every sugya. What you don't want to do is you don't want to allow this method to distort the purity of the lombus. So you've got to be able to keep an eye on that. Yes, when you're learning, that you don't get misled and you don't get the lombus right. The lombus has to be there first, even when you're teaching. You've got to learn it to the deepest level you can with the Shivisha lombus. When you've got that, then you start working on this. Two things. I'm not able to. Very nice. And they massage the timer. Very nice. Beautiful. Beautiful. How long can the worship last? I find it very difficult to give the worship for less than an hour. Yeah. I expect them to listen for usually an hour and a half. If I can't hold their attention for an hour to an hour and a half, then that's not a good shiur. Yeah, not everybody, but it's hard to get into something, and even a thing like this, how long does it take? You know the Gemara. Can you imagine if we're learning when we want to do that? Now, you could do it in Bifa, you could break it up. You don't have to do what we did in one shiur. You could do it in the sign, you could have a whole shiur and everything. An hour for people who knew an hour and a half is long, about 50 minutes, 5 hours, about. But less than that in Gemara, for a serious Gemara show. It's hard otherwise, you're just getting into it and then the show's over. 35 seconds. So you've got to start training. And the way you start training is to start linking the 35 seconds, just to make sure that every 35 seconds you've got a little bit of a something new, and then you start training them. I've trained them, earned them, because that was one of the biggest challenges in America, because in South Africa the concentration span is longer. Not a lot, but it's longer because they... Sorry? No, they didn't have television for a long time. So my door and then people even younger were not raised on television. And that has a lot to do with the concentration span. And other reasons too. America is very, very fast moving, and that has manners and has discernment. So one of the biggest things was to see whether I could train a tzibur in a reasonable amount of time to be able to listen to a shiur for a long time. So that's on two levels. The one is people are willing to already learn Gemara. That was hard enough, but that we did. And then it was Balabas and Stam, who came to a shiur. And particularly after hours, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, they came to learn after a long day. Could I train them to sit and listen for an hour? And I've done it.